There seems to be an implicit assumption that worldwide energy demand will continue to grow, something akin to a natural law, and that solutions should focus on ways to increase supply and/or efficiency of energy. But in an economic system based on self-interest on a finite planet, the true drivers of demand will need to be better understood beyond the microeconomic mantra of price will change behavior.
Is it possible that the solution to the global energy crisis lies not in increasing supply, but in decreasing demand, not so much in the ground as in our own attitudes? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What's the relationship between energy and money? How much energy does it take to produce energy? How much do our value systems have to do with our demand for energy? And how much does human evolution have to do with our value systems? Taking on these questions that seem to get bigger and bigger is Nate Higgins, a PhD candidate at the University of Vermont, Gund Institute for Ecological Economics, and editor of The Oil Drum, an online global think tank devoted to energy and sustainability. He's also the former president of Sanctuary Asset Management, managing director of Pension Research Institute, and vice president at the investment firms Solomon Brothers and Lehman Brothers. His talks in Wisconsin are sponsored by the Nelson Institute at the UW and Energy Hub.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
So how did you go from being a sort of Wall Street trader, investment banker, to taking on this huge question of energy?
Well, I started out as a high net worth broker out of MBA school, where we had to call on people that had a minimum of $50 million. And over time, I ended up working for one of my clients to actually manage money instead of doing sales. And I started investing in commodities and reading books about oil. And there were a couple books that really were light bulbs going off. Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight by Thomas Hartmann. And actually a book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, which in 1999 I read. And I put it down after 10 pages because it was some guy talking to a gorilla and I thought it was silly. But I picked it up again in 2002 and I read it all in one evening, and it hit me that the agricultural revolution 12,000 years ago and 250 years ago, us finding the ancient sunlight deposited in coal and subsequently oil and natural gas, have propelled us down this social trajectory that didn't necessarily have to happen. It was almost like some random chance, and then water has gone downhill since then. So it struck me that not only do we live on a finite planet, but you've got two intersecting forces. You've got human population and human demand are increasing, and you've got the second law of thermodynamics, the entropy law, working against you. Every time you transfer energy into something that's usable, there's a heat loss. And so I became very interested in those questions, and I shut down my small hedge fund, gave my clients their money back, and I went hiking for 9 months in British Columbia and read books all week and hiked with my dog and picked mushrooms and just reflected. And then I decided I wanted to come back to school at 37 and learn more about natural resources and the fact that externalities, for example, greenhouse gas emissions or water pollution, pesticides, those things were all external to the market. And no one was paying attention to those, and they were almost like the companies got a free ride in polluting. And I didn't think that was right. So my initial sense was, we're running out of resources. We're going to borrow what we can from the environment. And I wanted to study about how that would work. Subsequently, I learned about peak oil and a lot about our evolutionary drivers. And that's the two areas that I've been focusing on the last 2-3 years.
I wonder if any of your old hiking grounds in British Columbia have turned into shale oil grounds.
They haven't, but where I was in British Columbia by Terrence and Smithers, there have been a lot of coal bed methane civic meetings about we don't want the coal bed methane here and not in my backyard. And I actually attended some of those meetings when I was there, and people people there, people everywhere don't understand that they can want to protect the environment and want to do everything that's right, but they still use an amazing amount of fossil fuels. Canada uses more coal, oil, natural gas than the United States per capita. So I think education about just how large this energy subsidy that each of us has is part of the problem. And we take it for granted. This has been an amazing century.
So what kind of carbon footprint does any typical American have?
As far as carbon, I don't know. But as of 2007, the typical American used 30 barrels of oil per year and another 27 barrel of oil equivalents, the same BTU content of coal and natural gas, for a total of 57 barrel of oil equivalents, which if you – one barrel of oil has the amount of energy in it, British thermal units, 5.7 million, which is, depending on your assumptions, between 1 and 10 years of human labor working, you know, pulling down fiberglass or pushing wheelbarrows or doing carpentry. So in effect, we've got hundreds of energy slaves walking behind us at all times that make kings and queens of a few centuries ago look like paupers on average. And I hope we get a chance to talk about it, that a lot of this energy is not making us happy at all. We don't need all that energy.
You use the word addiction a lot in the essays you've got on your Oil Drum website. Can you talk about what you mean by addiction and to what extent we are indeed addicted to oil and the things that it does?
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm actually not an expert in anything other than finance, which I guess is kind of like being an expert in prayer or something.
But it is these days.
But when I talk about addiction, our brains have the neural wiring that was adaptive since our environment of evolutionary adaptation over, if you consider when we split off from the other ape line 5 million years ago, that's 20 years a generation, that's 250,000 generations of hominids of some sort. And our brains became adapted and improved to the environments we were around. We had very little stimulation then. And if you would see something that stood out, like a color against a bland background or a mountain, you could see things that were dangerous and things that would contribute to your health and nutrition, like a bird or some food or a honeycomb or et cetera. These same mechanisms in our reward pathways in our brain, when confronted with Las Vegas and Facebook and email and soccer practice and 200 different types of soda when you walk into the store that you could choose, they actually create neural grooves in our brain where we become habituated to various extents of continuing the same level or higher level of stimulation. So the word addiction in the clinical sense may not apply, but it's actually closer than you might think. There was a fascinating study a few years ago by a neuroscientist, Wolfram Schultz, who studied monkeys who were hooked up to a MRI where they measured each individual neuron in their brain, the dopamine neurons. And the monkeys heard a tone, and they received a splash of fruit juice. And their dopamine neurons were firing 3 per second until they got the unexpected fruit juice burst, and they went off the charts to 80 neurons a second. Then they gradually noticed that every time the monkey would get another shot of fruit juice, gradually he would become habituated to it. Mm-hmm. This is no longer that big of a deal. I'm used to this fruit juice. And eventually the tone followed by the fruit juice would be completely expected. And all this is based in learning theory. There's something called the Roscorla-Wagner function, which shows how we quickly learn new things, and then we've kind of got it after certain repetitions. Now, what happened with the monkey is then if they played the tone and there was no fruit juice, then the dopamine levels crashed, and the monkey was immediately having a feeling of seeking. And if you consider all the things in our society, alcohol, internet, coffee, sex, shopping, gambling, there's lots of things that we, because of all this coal, natural gas, and oil, are like a smorgasbord. Every day we wake up and the internet's waiting for you 24/7 and everything like that. So the relevance to addiction is that if all of a sudden our energy got, say, cut in half, there are those that would say, oh, well, we can be happy with half the energy. I agree, we can. But to go directly that point overnight without some transition period would be actually physically very difficult for people. I know myself, unfortunately, I am addicted to the internet, probably among other things. And if I go 3 or 4 days where I, for some physical reason, can't access the internet, I get pretty antsy. So I don't, of course, mean that we're addicted to the physical gooey substance of oil, but we are at least habituated as a culture to the things that oil has provided. And a lot of it is not healthy.
Even George W. Bush, who is not known as a guiding light in environmental issues and in energy conservation, said quite flatly in one of his later speeches, America is addicted to oil. And so, I mean, clearly there's a broad recognition that there is a dependency there.
Well, there is, especially since we import 70% of our oil, and now this whole credit crisis has completely changed the global supply structure of oil and North American natural gas. And, you know, this energy independence thing is just a it's a dead end. And I think it's
a dead end in the sense of current sources of energy, or
we,
just
we cannot
in general?
Be energy independent with anything close to this number of population or lifestyle, because the fossil fuels that are in the ground, you know, even though we import 70%, the cheapest oil remaining in the world, I think 2/3 of the remaining oil reserves in the world are within 600 or 700 miles of Baghdad. But I would think a much higher percentage of the cheap oil. The average oil in the United States to produce a new barrel is north of $60 today, and oil's at $49 or whatever.
Yeah, right around
so,
50.
So we need to have much higher oil prices in order to get out the oil. Otherwise, we're going to import more. Now, there are other people that would say, ah, well, so what? If as long as oil's fungible, so forget about protecting the United States oil and gas industry. Let's just import more of it, and then we'll export movies and massages and corn or whatever. And the problem with that is that oil is a depleting resource, and we've largely used not only half of it roughly, but we've used the easy half,
yes.
The cheap half.
Yes.
And you gave us a figure for the average American and how much oil per year gets used. If you took that amount of oil, what does it go for? How much goes toward heating, cars? You know, what is it that we're doing that you'd look at and see as the biggest culprits?
I don't know the specific numbers on that, but a large percentage of it is the trucks that deliver our foods and the individuals transporting back and forth to work, et cetera. So the large waste is, you know, there's heating oil is used for primarily the East Coast for winter heat. The Midwest uses primarily natural gas. But there's jet fuel and a lot of other petroleum products, you know, diapers and plastic bottles and things like that are made from natural gas. But I would say the largest misstep that could have been done differently is all these huge amount of internal combustion engines that are very inefficient, and they're in a large vehicle that's 2,000 or 3,000 pounds carrying a 200-pound person everywhere. And we've gone down this path-dependent trajectory where it's very difficult to transition that to something more local or more electric-based trains in a short period of time.
Because of the infrastructure, you mean? In other words, you could have a car with a rechargeable battery instead of an internal combustion engine, but where would you recharge it? Between here and California, say. I mean, there's no infrastructure for that as there is for gas.
That's part of the problem. The infrastructure is definitely an issue because we have – just like when you go to a restaurant, you order a $50 lobster or steak and you get full halfway through it, you feel like you have to keep eating it because you've already paid the money. It's the same thing with our transportation infrastructure. It seems too large to change. But the other issues are – first of all, it's got to be affordable to everyone. The average fleet, you know, we have 200 million odd vehicles in this country, and the total fleet turnover takes 17 years. So you can't just say, we're switching to electric cars and here's one for everyone, unless you just give it away. And that further decouples our monetary situation from physical reality. And the other problem is we have a penchant to focus on the limiting variable du jour. And the last couple of years, it was oil. Oil went from $10.99 to $147 last year, and we had a liquid fuels problem. So they decided to combine corn, coal, and natural gas into ethanol. But when we start to focus on one thing that's limiting, we don't really do it in a systems manner, and all of a sudden some other things become limiting. For example, if we did use roughly the same electricity mix as we use now, and we did turn every car into electric cars, there would be the steel and the raw materials needed for the cars, but there's also a significant water problem. Electric cars use between 4 and 17 times the water consumed or water withdrawn because of the larger electricity demand than gasoline-powered cars. So then all of a sudden you've got a water problem. It was really telling that in his first interview as Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, a couple weeks ago, said that 90% of the snowpack due to climate change in the Sierras could disappear, and that would have major impacts on agriculture and water in California. He never even mentioned energy. He was talking about water and climate change, which, you know, I don't know where the truth lies on that, but certainly we're running up against many different limits. It's not just energy.
Well, as we found also with corn, as soon as we decided to go to corn-based ethanol, suddenly the corn crop was getting sucked into this black hole. And then we also found, I guess, that there were indirect effects even down in South America where parts of the rainforest would be cut down to plant crops that were somehow being used up because of the whole corn and ethanol situation. So the things became more like dominoes than was expected.
The law of unintended consequences. And also, I would say, the law of receding horizons as well, because you mentioned shale oil earlier. Shale oil has always been considered the energy of the future, and it still is. Because it takes energy to procure energy, right? I mean, we think it costs dollars, which dollars are just a marker for real assets. So in the 1930s, it took one unit of energy, one barrel, to get out 100 or more. It was like Beverly Hillbillies, stuff bubbling out of the ground. And then in the 70s, that ratio for U.S. went down to 30 to 1. And by the year 2000, it was a range of 10 to 17 to 1, and anecdotally, it's much less than that now. Eventually, if you get to a point where quality adjusted, it takes you one barrel of oil to pump out one barrel. It doesn't matter if oil prices are $100 or $100,000 a barrel. You're out of gas. So that's what's called the law of receding horizons. Things always look like they're going to be profitable until you actually get there, and then all your other costs have kind of gone up as well. That's an issue with the tar sands in Canada. There's a huge amount of hydrocarbon resource there, but it's less developed. It's less mature than oil in geological terms, and it doesn't flow at room temperatures. There needs to be processed, et cetera. So there are energy costs that go into that before we can actually use it.
You mentioned that Canadians use more per capita energy?
More oil. I'm not sure about coal.
Is that just because it's colder and they have to...
They actually use more air conditioning, believe it or not.
That surprises me somehow.
Yeah. It was a couple years ago that I looked into that. It may have changed now, but we use 30% of the world's resources, Americans do. I mean, I don't know where they're at, but both of us are highly guilty of living high on the pyramid.
I was surprised to hear during the current plunge in oil prices and demand that the demand also dropped sharply in China, because we always think of them as being just sort of an out-of-control venue for energy consumption without any kind of regulation or even economic restrictions. But apparently there was a drop in demand there as there was in the United States.
Well, a couple things here. Number one is oil and all commodities are priced at the marginal unit. So it doesn't think – I mean, look at a chart of the prices of the last century. They're not predicting scarcity, or it doesn't matter where things ultimately will be. They only care about equating supply and demand right at the margin. Secondly, we're their largest customer. So if our economy suffers, they're not going to send us a bunch of stuff on these container ships that use oil to get here. But most importantly, we went off the gold standard in 1971, which was a year after the United States peaked in oil production. And since then, we've not had any tether to natural resources with our monetary system. So Chinese currency, U.S. currency, European currencies, they're all really abstractions that because of a generation of, I believe that you will accept this green and white piece of paper in exchange for that wheelbarrow, that has become completely accepted within our culture. Yet now with quantitative easing, with all these credit derivatives and debt, et cetera, no one really knows how many assets are underlying the claims on the assets. And it looks like there's a global game of musical chairs going on right now. And the administration and the European Central Bank are quick trying to put a lot of money, trillions of dollars, into the economy in hopes that gets more chairs. But here's a statistic. From 75 to the mid-80s, 14% of our corporate profits were in the financial sector. In the 1990s, it was 25%, and it's in the decade of the 21st century so far, it's been 40% of our GDP has been financial profits.
So we're not actually producing products so much as just generating paper.
Well, not only that, but that may all end up being phantom once we look back. You know, 5 years from now, looking back, we don't know how much of that was real profits. Yes, it was paper. Now, here's where it gets amazingly complex and scary. So world GDP in 2007 was $55 trillion. Now, I would imagine a large chunk of that was financial. But on top of that, you've got corporate debt, government debt, household debt. You've got complex derivatives on Wall Street, which they're trying to cut back on. You've got Wall Street firms themselves able to lever up 30 times on their capital. They're also cutting back on that. If you add all that up, it adds up to 1.6 quadrillion, which is a statistic I saw last week, which is 1,600 trillion of IOUs. Now, it's unclear how much of those is Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs have a Swiss currency swap where if they called each other out, it might cancel out. There might be a good deal of that is like that, but I kind of doubt it. So that's how demand can go down. We, with all these derivatives and all this leverage, and in 1999, repeal of the Glass-Steagall and these no-doc, low-doc loans and easy money, we basically turned the money spigot on full blast. And that actually, in the short run, caused an increase in energy supply because there was more money sloshing around the world, more people wanted oil, et cetera. So supply tried as hard as it could to increase from 2005 to 2008 was on a plateau. But now demand is going to rule the day, in my opinion, for quite some time because you've got all this money. Even though they're adding a few trillion here and there, that pales in comparison to the larger amount of outstanding credit and debt. So I think demand is going to be low relative to where it was for quite some time. The problem with that is while this is happening, real natural depletion is occurring in the world's oil fields and particularly in the U.S. natural gas fields, which the newest ones deplete at 60 or 70% in the first year. So if we drop to we've already dropped 50% of our natural gas rigs, and we're probably going to drop more because the price is so low that once we do emerge and once our demand does come back online, we're going to meet smack into energy limits on oil and gas. And even worse than that is now the prices are so low that a lot of these alternatives, which have much longer production profiles, wind turbines, solar panels, wind turbines for sure, have higher energy returns than oil and gas right now. But you don't get the energy right away. You get it in equal spurts over 20 years. And the market can't really afford that.
Wait for the payback.
Yeah, so that's an issue.
No wonder you headed for the woods for 9 months.
Yeah, I'd like to go back.
More on energy sources when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Our topic for this hour, supply, demand, and natural resources on a full planet. And we've just gotten into this idea of it taking so much energy to produce energy. Now, particularly, it's less efficient than it used to be because the energy we're getting often is much harder to get than it was 50 or 100 years ago. So what about the whole issue, though, of conservation? We talked about how much it costs to produce certain things. How can we find some way around that without just being much more efficient in the way we produce energy?
Well, you mentioned efficiency. Energy return on investment, energy return on energy investment is efficiency of supply. It's partially to do with the quality of the resource and partially to do with our technology. But on the consumption side, there's also efficiency. There's how efficient the company can get the product to you and how efficient you can use it. But there's some interesting concepts that go along with that. There was an economist in the 1800s, Walter Stanley Jevons, who came up with something called Jevons Paradox, which he observed once the steam engines got more efficient and at using coal, he hypothesized that we would use less coal because they were more efficient. But right. In reality, there was just an explosion of more engines and more growth all over the place. So it actually caused resource consumption to go up. So I think conservation is key. We have to do conservation, but I would approach it a little bit differently than we typically hear about. I think if you just see a message that says, oh, we're running low on resources, you should conserve, and you use a couple barrels less of oil per year, that's going to end up as 200 square feet of cement in China. Someone is going to use that oil. So the way to look at it is, in my opinion, and I've been efforting this on my own life, though it's difficult, is to view it and understand it that we are conditioned to compete and want more. More is defined however culture tells us. But if we know that no matter how much money we make, we want to make a little bit more, or no matter how much we have of something, we want a little bit more, that to realign your own life saying, I know I've seen statistics that show the United States uses 39 times the primary energy of the Philippines. Yet Filipinos in subjective well-being studies, other happiness studies, are equally as happy as Americans. There are lots of things that we compete for that are called Veblen goods. Thorstein Veblen was an economist that said we buy goods in order to have badges that show that we are successful competitors.
And it's just conspicuous consumption.
Conspicuous consumption, keeping up with the Joneses. I got an extra boat because Joe next door bought a boat, etc. But if we tell ourselves that we can be happier and have fuller lives without all this energy, if we can substitute – see, here's the thing. Down the road, oil is going to get less available. Now, whether it's less expensive or more expensive in nominal prices, I don't know. But over time, we're going to have some issues with energy. And if you know that, it's wise to conserve anyways. But if you do it because you want to improve your own life by substituting one unit of time and one unit of labor for this money and energy that our society has taught us that we should pursue, it actually will make you happier and healthier, because so many of us now are maxed out with our cognitive load. Theory suggests that the human brain can handle 7 chunks of information at once. And if you have 4 or 5 at one time, you're doing pretty well. And once you get to 5 or 6, your processor gets a little slow. And at 7, you really can't handle any new input without losing some other thing you were thinking about. And the more cognitively maxed out we are, the less we can plan for the future, the more we focus just on the present moment. So if instead of 10 hours a day on the computer and responding to emails and then your BlackBerry, et cetera, because time is money after all, right? If the average person makes $20, $30 an hour, you don't want to waste an hour doing gardening. Well, I mean, that you'd be better off making the money, right?
If you're talking in terms of sheer dollars and cents.
In sheer dollars and cents, right. But that hour of physical labor or 2 hours or 5 hours or whatever actually slows everything down a little bit in your brain and allows you to think clearer. And yeah, you might not make as much money, but you might also enjoy it or trade your time with someone else or do things more connected to our physical realities than the paper and the internet, et cetera. Now, I should talk because I get like 1,000 emails a week just because of what I'm studying and what I'm doing. But I can talk because I've seen it in my own life, what's happened, and my friends around me. We have physical manifestations because of our behavior, and it ends up with people being serotonin deficient, and which causes dopamine cravings, which can be quenched by buying things or competing or gambling. I mean, all things that really are not the best for us in the long term. So yeah, I think conservation is important, but you have to root policy and behavioral changes in selfish interest. Because people might say, yeah, let's all go conserve, but then they're going to go home and okay, I'm cold tonight. I'm turning the heat on a little bit, rather than going getting a sleeping bag in the basement because it takes 3 minutes to dig it out, et cetera. So there's a whole smorgasbord of these behavioral changes that I think can be made and will be made. And I think the areas that kind of, you know, we're very good imitators. Humans. And if we see people around us doing something and they seem happy and healthy and other people emulate and respect them, we're very likely to follow their behavior, which is why I got the heck out of New York City.
Imagine that.
One thing that's different now than it would have been quite a long time ago is that everybody recycles pretty much. I mean, you have recycled bins, you know, you've got a bottled water sitting there and that would go in a different container. How much of that really matters?
Because I've
wondered that, you know, faithfully, this is on a daily basis. You separate out your paper, you put a can or a bottle in a different receptacle. But I've heard that there's a lot of energy that goes into trying to cope with all this recyclable material.
It's like going to church and lighting a candle. It makes you feel good, but I don't know that it's really accomplishing that much. I don't know the actual statistics, but I know that the aluminum cans, definitely that's a net positive by doing that. But just think about 57 barrel of oil equivalents. I use more than that probably because I travel, but that's the average American. If you recycle everything that you use, I doubt that would save one barrel of oil. So the decision, and then there are people that drive electric cars versus larger cars. And yeah, that makes a difference, but the whole aircraft carrier needs to shift. Those people then, if you really wanted to conserve energy, you would go vegetarian because a meat-based diet uses way more energy than the choice between driving a car and a Prius does. I mean, there's all sorts of issues like that. But here's the problem is that there are so many environmentally aware, environmentally concerned people that really want to make things better, but they have one foot in both worlds. And you need to have a job and pay for things. Just you need to make $30,000 a year in the United States just to be like have normal rights. Other than that, you can't be a regular citizen, it seems to me. And so we've got one foot in the dying paradigm. I've never used that term before, but I do believe that that is the case. And one foot in what comes next. And I don't know how to not have one foot in both worlds effectively. But I don't want to completely denigrate recycling and bringing your own plastic bottle and not buying new ones every day. But in the scheme of our behavior, wind turbines and solar panels and recycling are not going to cut it. We need major change in what we're doing because it's going to happen to us regardless. So to make the changes on your own gives you a head start, in my opinion.
But won't the problem be that you've got people calling for such things way back, like Thoreau going out to Walden Pond and talking about how you could have all this time to just enjoy life if you quit working for material things. But they're sort of lone voices that get stifled often.
Well, this gets to the concept of, in economics, it's called the discount rate. And in psychology, it's called impulsivity. It's a measure of how much we value the present versus the future. And economists measure this with choices between a small short-term reward and a larger long-term reward sometime in the future. And depending on how much you prefer the present versus the future, that measures the discount rate. Discount rate is between 0 and 1. 1 would be like a goldfish or a dog. You absolutely only care about the present moment. If you give me food, I'm going to eat it till it's gone. A discount rate of 0 would be if you were a robot and you lived 300,000 years, then you would really care about the year 2100 because it's really not that far in the future. So humans, you know, we're all genetically predisposed to care about the present more than the future. You can think about why that would be because we have finite lifespans and those of our ancestors that said, oh, I found this great little cache of food, I'm going to save it for 10 years, would have been outproduced. But what happens is we we need a smoking gun. We need something in our face that says, oh my gosh, there's an urgent problem. We need to. And our brains were not designed to think about issues like peak oil and climate change that are these broad, sweeping 10, 20, 100-year problems. Look at our environmental success stories. DDT, unleaded gasoline, chlorofluorocarbons, all those things had smoking guns. There was something happening that people could tangibly see.
Like dying animals.
Like dying animals, sick people, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So until we actually see those things, even my discussion about debt, people still don't understand that energy is what we have to spend. And dollars is just who has the energy for now. They're so conditioned to believe that dollars are what matters, that all these trillions that are getting thrown into the system, they still haven't seen the bottom of that. I mean, it's like we are heroin addicts and we have a bad headache now with this credit crisis and they're giving us some opium via easy money and credit. So until we see the whites of the eyes of either peak oil, like national gasoline shortages like in the 70s, or credit crisis, meaning your own bank, you're limited to taking $50 out a day type of thing, people aren't going to get it. But the problem is once we see that, it's too late to really have long-term thinking, because then everyone's worried about, you know, their own situation and how's grandma doing. Right now is the perfect time to really change some of these principles, because I think, you know, the American people may not on average understand biophysical economics, but I think the average person does understand that something's not quite right. I forget who it was that said it recently, but a crisis is, I think it was Rahm Emanuel said, a good crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And I kind of feel the same way.
Learn from it, benefit from it, make changes.
Well, people are ready to make changes. We've had two major crises now with the last two presidents. George Bush, after 9/11, said, everything's going to be okay. People go out and shop. And that was a huge missed opportunity where we could have said, look, we're dependent on foreign oil. This terrorist attack had something to do with that. We need to revisit our values and, you know, do things closer to home, grow a victory garden or whatever. And now this credit crisis, Obama could have done the same thing, yet is trying to, you know, one guy can't do everything. And he has made some attempts at changing. But it seems to me that he's being advised by economists that really don't understand the physical tether concept, nor do they understand the demand angle, which is we are the world's carrot. What we do, at least the last generation, other countries want to follow what we're doing. There are so many poor people in Africa and South America and the Indian subcontinent that already have it ingrained that they want to grow up and have a car and have a lifestyle like an American. And, you know, if every Chinese would consume as much as I do, we would need three planet Earths. Well, that's the average person. I'm like 6'5", 250. We'd probably need five.
Well, if we look at technology, which has driven so much of the demand, it seems to me, in the past 100 years, what sort of things would people give up that they didn't have 100 years ago or 120 years ago? I mean, give up air conditioning? Give up private transportation?
Well, when I'm talking about behaviorally improving your life, more of my meaning is just to slow down and substitute pecuniary material goods for getting more social relationships and friends, family, neighbors. There was a study done by Richard Easterlin at USC that tracked people over 2 decades on how many things, material goods, they desired, their wish list, like a private jet, a Humvee or whatever. And then they tracked them over 17 years and these people actually achieved, they reached their goals in a lot of cases. But every time they checked in, they also had to say, what are your goals now? No matter how many things they got, their desires went up more.
It's back to that dopamine thing.
It just requires more stimulus to get
the high from the
That's right.
Same
so
thing.
If you think of that monkey example, well, once we get habituated to the internet and some of these other things, you can't easily go back down to just go watching your tomatoes grow because your brain is expecting something else. One of the children of a good friend of mine is 10. And last year, she would read books. I bought her books, the same books that I read when I was a kid. And she started to read them and really liked them. And then she got on this Facebook stuff. Mm-hmm. And now she literally cannot read. Because she picks up a book and reads a few sentences. And, of course, she's able to read. But her brain is craving more stimulation than just that, what that book can offer.
It's kind of interesting if you try this exercise sometime and watch television, especially from a distance without benefit of sound, and you time the length of the average shot in television, it would be 1 to 3 seconds.
Yeah, it's amazing. I would, if I had a children, which I don't, I would not let them watch TV until they were 12 or 13. It actually impacts how our brains are formed, the whole two-dimensional. The fact that when you read something, you are actively engaging your brain with alpha waves. When you watch something on TV, it's engaging your brain with beta waves, which are totally passive. And I think that is totally unrelated to everything we've talked about so far, is a big problem with our culture, which is why people aren't angry and really have a lot of angst about what's happening to the country right now, is because we've become kind of passive. And we just, okay, well, whatever you say, we'll figure it out.
Well, let's see. I think it was Hemingway who referred to television as the opiate of the masses, taking his cue from Marx talking about religion.
I have not had a television in 7 years, but I've replaced it with the internet,
unfortunately. Not true, of course, of radio, which is a much more stimulating medium that requires the use of the imagination. Let's look at the role that evolution has played in getting us to our current sad state of energy depletion. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air.
Most of these people in the nations of the United States are extremely eager in the pursuit of immediate material pleasures and are always discontented with the position they occupy. They think about nothing but ways of changing their lot and bettering it. An American will build a house in which to pass his old age and sell it before the roof is on. He will plant a garden and rent it just as the trees are coming into bear. He will take up a profession and leave it, settle in one place and soon go off elsewhere with his changing desire. Yet at the end of the year, crammed with work, he has little spare leisure. His restless curiosity goes with him, traveling up and down the vast territories of the United States. That's a description by Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America in 1831. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Nate Higgins, and we're talking about supply, demand, and natural resources on a full planet. That quote that you include on your website from 1831 is an eye-opener about the fact that we always, as Americans, seem to be pursuing material goods. Have we really not gotten any better?
You could have had that quote last year and it would have sounded contemporary. I don't know if it's better, but, you know, this country was, with the exception of the Native American Indians, was empty. And we were a self-selected migrant group on average that came from Europe seeking our fortune. We were ambitious, restless, etc. And over time, people stayed in the East Coast and the more restless continued moving west until, you know, Los Angeles is about the biggest melting pot migrant culture on the whole planet. But what's happened is that we have had amazing abundance of resources in this country. We've produced more oil than any country in the world, even though we've been declining for 39 years. And we have followed our evolutionary drive of competing for whatever the cultural metric tells us to compete for. And I don't know that we're genetically different than Europeans. There have been some studies show that there are different dopamine receptors that Americans might have more preponderance of based on the trajectories out of Africa. But that type of study is kind of frowned on, and I don't think we really know. But certainly one of the messages, and you know, we don't have a lot of time to hash this out, but we have genetic leashes based on our ancestral environment. Some of the leashes are short, some are long. Culture can shift us in different directions. Our culture has promoted keeping up with the Joneses, conspicuous consumption. Wow, that guy has a big house. You know, that must mean he's influential, et cetera. And this is rooted in the biological concept of relative fitness, which is you and your family's genes getting passed on as the ultimate genetic goal. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm thinking about a behavior to buy a car or a house because, ooh, that's going to be better for my genes. It's accessed in your neurotransmitter cocktail that you get when you buy that car because you know that car is a status symbol within our culture. So there's some biological theory called sexual selection, which is male-male competition within the same species and female choice for males within the species. There is female-female competition as well, but predominantly those two other criteria had a huge impact on our ancestral environment. If you think about 99% of our evolutionary past, we were polygynous. Men at the bottom of the pecking order had no offspring. A female has a one-year investment into an offspring, and a man has, what, 10 minutes? So women are always at a premium. So culturally, throughout the years, throughout the millennia, we try to move jockey higher and higher up on the mating ladder. And there's actually a concept called the handicap principle by a biologist, Amos Zahavi, that suggests that waste is actually evolutionary selected for. If you consider a peacock's tail, a peacock is a great example of sexual selection. This huge, ornate, colorful tail is actually a hindrance to the survival of the peacock. A, it makes him more conspicuous to a lion or a predator. B, if the lion or predator sees him, he's got to run away and it's gonna slow him down. So those two negative fitness hits have to be overcome by the genetic advantage of a female peahen choosing him over a more drab conspecific. So this happens throughout the animal kingdom. And
so the peacock, if he had a Humvee, then he would be
that's right.
More likely to get the top-grade peahen.
Well, on average, and I think political power in humans has always been the top goal. The people who are the highest in political power, even, you know, a million years ago, had the most likely
alpha males.
Exactly. But it hasn't always been conspicuous consumption. There were the potlatch cultures, the potlatch Indians in the Pacific Northwest, that they would compete by giving the neighboring tribe the most lavish feast they could. And then the neighboring tribe would try and one-up them and give them – they would try and give away as much as they could in a feast. So it doesn't mean – I mean, yes, our society right now, primarily due to advertising and the lobbyists in Washington, have this tight stronghold on our political decisions. But money is correlated to this right now. Money, because money gives you options. Money is what biologists would say, it's a cheat-free display of fitness. Because if you can spend $200,000 on a Lamborghini, that will give a signal to a woman or you know, a possible mate that, well, this guy's got money to burn, which means it's going to be good resources for me and my offspring. And I don't think that they may actually be thinking those things, but it's just the cultural reinforcement that we get. So we have bigger things. We've got the Happy Meal. We've got bigger houses. We got everything is bigger in our country. And it's just amazing how this has been a maladaptive cultural trajectory where we're using and spending all these finite resources and we're not happier because of it. So the message there is, yes, we compete. I think we're hardwired to compete. And that is one that I would term a short genetic leash. But we can change what we compete for. And that happens through leading by example and by culture and by imitation. And it would be great if – well, look at what Michelle Obama is doing, growing a
yes.
garden
mm-hmm.
in the White – I mean, that's – those are the type of examples that might have huge leverage in future years because they set an example.
I saw that you'd written some letters to President Obama about some of your ideas about energy. What are some of the things you most hope that his administration would do in the next few years?
Well, to be honest, I wrote that a couple, 3 months ago, and I think I would answer my question differently today than I did then. I don't think that the market system as we know it can continue because we've become so disconnected from physical markers. I think, you know, giving people $500 or $600 stimulus checks ends up getting spent at Dollar General or Walmart on stuff that within 6 months is gone. Why wouldn't he do something radical and send everyone a certificate for a local bicycle because that forces them to change their behavior? Yeah, some people wouldn't ride the bicycles, but then we'd have a couple hundred million bicycles sitting around the country. You know, I think we need to really think outside the box. I think we should eliminate leverage. We need to eliminate fractional banking system eventually. Right now, if you deposit $100,000 in the bank can instantly go out and lend a million. Money is created out of thin air. We eventually need to get back to where that $100,000 is real money, and the bank acts as a banker as opposed to a casino operator. And then they loan that $100,000 out to someone else, and the spread on the two is what the banks earn. Right now, it's completely decoupled. So that would be the main thing. But of course, there's going to be the steep discount rate, right? All the politicians, none of them are going to want to say, well, let's get rid of the stock market as it is, or let's get rid of fractional reserve banking, because their constituents would be up in arms. The best recommendation I give Obama, get rid of Larry Summers and the neoclassical economists that are spewing this stuff that is not proven. Economics, both on the supply and demand side, is based on cheap energy. Without infinite supply of perfect substitutes and affordable substitutes, real wages have peaked 35 years ago in our country. And, you know, I think debt and cheap energy has allowed for a camouflaging of what really are two social classes seem like one. So I think to start to rely on ecological economics, which means you're going to include the environment. The economy is part of the environment, not vice versa. And biophysical economics start to take account of our real assets, energy, natural resources, water, et cetera. And on the demand side, I would hire a secretary of demand, someone that integrated, had a staff of cognitive neuroscientists, evolutionary biologists, evolutionary psychologists, anthropologists, hunter-gatherer, because we need to be more in line with who we are. And our consumptive society right now is totally decoupled from that, both on the supply and the demand side.
And in the meantime, tend to your garden. Our guest has been Nate Higgins this hour, and it's been quite a fascinating, I want to say not just tour, but tour de force in the areas of energy consumption, finance, and also values. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.